Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Millions of Screens. I'm creator producer Leo Garcia, joined via Zoom by TV Awards editor Libby Hill and TV deputy editor Ben Travers. Today we're going to be talking about the HFPA holes who won't be on NBC in 2022. We'll also be talking about cancel culture.
Did you say HFPA holes like a-holes of the HFPA?
Never. Never would say that.
It's sad. I had respect for you for a fleeting moment.
And then we'll be turning our attention to the state of comedy with a couple of big comedy shows hitting, either launching last week or returning last week. In the case of Mythic Quest, Hacks launching today, if you're listening, on the day this is released. And Breeders wrapping up its second season in a couple of weeks. And I'll give everyone a chance to speak on that. Everyone will get a chance to talk about which comedy they're stumping for.
About Breeders?
Oh, yeah. No. Everyone can stump for Breeders.
Good.
It is the millions and millions of little screens.
Can't you shut up? I'm busy.
Boy, what a great show.
Skipping ahead to the clicker, our recap of the biggest news items from this past week. Guys, it's no secret that the biggest news that hit the wire over the course of this week was the fact that NBC declined to pick up the Golden Globes for 2022, canceling them, if you will, in the wake of all the mounting controversy we've talked about in the podcast before. The HFPA, sort of always kind of a vague laughingstock and sort of corrupt entity, but that LA Times piece back in February sort of like set the whole thing on fire. And then there were even more sort of complaints growing that they weren't making changes after it was acknowledged that they had zero black members amongst their 87 voting panel. And they just weren't making changes at all. Just kind of proceeding business as usual. A couple of the consulting firms that were trying to help them through this were just like, well, we're out. We're not helping anymore.
Always a good sign.
Yeah, so NBC has decided to forego their relationship in 2022, with leaving the door open for maybe we'll come back in 2023 if they can get their house in order. Ben, you wrote about this for the site, sort of saying, you know, here are some potential replacements for the Globes. Libby, you have spoken extensively on pod, off pod, about the fact that, you know, good riddance to the Globes, and maybe it's time for some structural change in the awards season calendar. But what were your guys' sort of thoughts on just NBC actually coming out and canceling the Golden Globes?
Honestly, my first thought was, I didn't know they could do that. And then my second thought was, I didn't think they would do that, just because, for what it is, I mean, that's taking a stand on something, and you don't see that a lot with corporations, especially one that might cost them money. But considering how the Golden Globes ratings cratered this year, I think NBC was just decided to cut its losses, decided to take a win in the PR department. And I don't blame them. It's the right call. Like, the Golden Globes never deserved to be as seemingly influential in the film world, at least, as they were. They didn't deserve all the ink that was spilled over them. They didn't deserve any prestige whatsoever. And now we're slowly kind of, you know, dismantling them to become the film version of the Cable Ace Awards. And good riddance.
One of the things that stands out to me about the timing of this announcement is that we are in the midst, as we've widely noted on the podcast, of ratings crater when it comes to award shows. And the Golden Globes signed an extremely lucrative deal with NBC that if ratings dipped, as we saw they dipped this year, if they continued to drop as much as they did, would have meant a huge overvaluation of that show. It just wouldn't have been worth it to them. So by announcing that they're going to suspend it this year, I don't know how that affects the actual contract, but I would imagine that it would be a pretty good renegotiation tactic after this year, when they get to watch and see how all the other award shows perform, and if the ratings bounce back or if the ratings stay low, and then if they do decide, or another network decides, that the Golden Globes are worth revisiting, they'll just bring it back at a much cheaper cost. So I think it's a little preemptive to say that the Golden Globes are gone and dead. I am definitely surprised and enthusiastic that it's trending that way, that there's at least one foot in the grave. But in Hollywood, nothing ever ends, as we know. So I'm suspicious to believe fully that this is the last we've heard of the Golden Globes.
I am very curious because it was in that LA Times piece from February, it was revealed, or accusations were revealed, that the Globes were self-dealing, paying members to create content for the Golden Globes. So my big question is, without the deep pockets of NBC, can the HFPA continue to exist, as an organization, just like running costs? It doesn't feel like an organization that has a ton of money, squirreled away for a rainy day. It certainly seemed like they were using every dollar they got. So I'm very curious for how long they can continue existing without kind of a generous benefactor.
Ben, you also reminded me, aside from like the fact that, you know, they were snubbing shows like I May Destroy You, not attending press conferences for shows such as Bridgerton, Girls Trip, and Queen and Slim, the show was also just really bad. That's like, for all the money that NBC was giving them, and I think this speaks to Libby's self-dealing comment and like not squirreling money away for a rainy day. They had the laziest of any of the award shows during pandemic.
Well, it's an interesting compare and contrast with what happened at the Oscars, in which a lot of people claimed that, you know, the mentality of the producers was basically, hey, we know a ton of people aren't going to tune into this. We know it's going to be a down year. So we're going to make this ceremony for the people who are there. We're going to invest everything, you know, into making it an intimate space and you know, redeveloping and basically saying, you know, okay, we're not going to worry about attracting a ton of viewers this year. We're just going to worry about putting on the best show we can for the people in the house, which, you know, we discussed at the time already. But It's I guess it's starting at the same ideas it seemed like the Golden Globes people started with, except the Golden Globes people were like, well, we're going to lose a lot of viewership this year. We're not going to put any effort in at all. We're not going to worry about making it look good for the people in the building or the people sitting at home. So see you later.
But here's the thing. It would be one thing if they did that and conserve funds, but they didn't. They used their money in very stupid ways. And by that, I mean having a dual coast broadcast that no one was asking for and that looked like shit. So instead of having one single location, one set, one crew, they doubled it for negative effects. Here's something I don't hear people talking about enough, and this is the last thing I have to say on this matter. But didn't the Emmys look good this year? Weren't the Emmys like a fine time, an original time? Weren't they just a real achievement in pandemic awards ceremonies?
And they were first out the gate.
First best.
And yeah, they definitely stand in defiance to the idea that you couldn't put on an entertaining award show during a pandemic for people at home, which was one thing that I did hear in defense of this year's Oscars, where it was just like, listen, of course they should just make it an intimate, in the room focused event. I was like, no, that's still not exactly what it is. So, you know, look to your ancestors. Look to history, people.
Look to your ancestors. But yeah, it's like if you have only watched the Golden Globes and then you watch the Oscars, you're like, oh, this is as good as it can get. But wrong.
And Libby, I'll give you a moment here to just really quickly say what you think the Emmys should do in 2022.
It breaks my heart because, like, I just keep beating this drum. And every time I beat this drum, I know in my heart that the reason it doesn't happen is because of money. And history. I hate history. But the Emmy should move to the Oscars, to the film award schedule. They should take the Golden Globe spot. They should serve as like a bookend for the Oscars and the Emmys. That would give more credence and importance to the Guild Awards. It would build in more anticipation for the Emmys themselves. People would maybe remember to watch them because they aren't in the middle of fucking September for no reason. For no reason that makes sense for the last 20 years. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to adhere to an outmoded version of television that would debut in September and end in May. Like, it's, I don't know. I'm running out of words to say.
What?
The Emmys should move to the Golden Globe spot.
With the advent of streaming and the ever blurring lines between what is quote unquote film and what is television, why not have the two biggest award shows, the Emmys and the Oscars, to Libby's point, bookend the entire award season and sandwich everything else in between them? And have it so that the Emmys open it up, you get all the guilds, the Oscars close it, everyone is happy. All right, well, moving on to my joking cancel culture segment of the clicker. Donald Glover tweeted some pretty cryptic tweets that we picked up here at IndieWire, where he was essentially stating, saw people on here having discussion about how tired they were of reviewing boring stuff, TV and film, and we're getting boring stuff and not even experimental mistakes because people are afraid of getting canceled. Now, some people read this as a potential, you know, as in the zeitgeist right now, this cancel culture. But I think all of us on the panel seem to think what he's really talking about is the literal definition of canceled, the way that TV people know it is like, your show won't exist anymore because it doesn't bring the studio the money it needs to.
To a certain extent, this is true primarily, I think, of, I guess, network shows that will still get pulled like 3 episodes in if they bomb hard enough. But yeah, that's a very real thing. Like, if you go out on a limb and people don't connect with what you're doing, then yeah, you're probably going to get yanked. It's a real fear. It's a real fear for people, especially newcomers, up and coming talent in the industry, is like, you have this one shot. It's a 1 in a million opportunity. And like, there is this very real fear that if you make something outrageous, it won't connect and you're done. And then you're done in the industry and then you're done with everything. There's a lot at stake. And it used to be, there used to be more time given. And it is an advantage of streaming that at least you'll get a full season out. But it's scary. And I don't think his assessment is wrong.
Yeah. Although it's wrong how people responded to it.
Oh yeah, people's interpretation of his assessment were wrong. But his assessment, I think, is dead on.
I agree with what you guys are saying, and I absolutely feel like most of the TV we watch these days is TV that's built to mirror another successful product, because that's how the conversation is turned. Like, it feels like with, and it's not just the, you know, the addition of Marvel and the MCU and, you know, Star Wars to television that has led us this way, but it really feels like TV used to be the place where the mid-budget dramas that Hollywood no longer made as movies would go. And now it's like, no, we don't need those either. Like, TV can be the place where we just have blockbusters too. And, you know, that's really disappointing. Like, there's not as many outlets, not as many distributors, not as many studios looking for those shows that will break the mold. Like, there's not as much of a belief out there that if we make that one show that is completely distinct and is our own, we can build a brand around that. It's turned into, no, we have this massive IP because we're part of a conglomerate. We can use that to hook people in much easier than taking a risk on something artistic. And that's very sad. And one of the reasons why it's very exciting that the Underground Railroad is coming out, because it's magnificent, guys. It's just so good. So go watch that. Hold on to that last bit. Yeah.
I will say,
eventually.
I will say, I have heard from people that even when you go to outlets that are expressly looking for certain types of stories to tell, when you are selling something like that, they want to know what successful property it's like. Like, is this could this be successful to us like This Is Us was for NBC? Could this be successful to us in a way that, in a prestige way that, I don't know, Pen 15 is for Hulu? Like, what do I know and love that this is like? Because they can't comprehend it any other way. They can't see the potential. It has to be based in something that already exists. And that's not how art is always made, or ever made. But it's the only language they speak. So I think that's another reason we get things that just seem like slightly altered versions of some other story.
Well, and there's a book coming out that I'm forgetting the name of, sadly, that's about Amazon and kind of how Amazon came to be. And a few of the notations from that book were making the rounds on Twitter. One of which was that Jeff Bezos claimed that he knew how to make great TV. It was obvious. You just have to follow these 7 easy steps. And then he would check in on all of his shows to make sure that they were following each and every one of those steps. And Roy Price, who was head of Amazon at the time, diligently obeyed these orders while secretly telling his staff that, you know, sometimes the great artists have to break from this mold. Like, you can't just follow the rules all the time. Sometimes you have to trust the people who are creating it, know what they're doing, and follow that artistic integrity, which is how we got a lot of, you know, the very experimental, very strange early Amazon Prime Video shows. But it doesn't feel like that exists anymore. It doesn't feel like there's room for that belief in the executive mindset anymore. It's much more the executive belief of, no, I know this works. We can recreate it. That's a much easier path to believe in from a business standpoint.
Bosch probably followed all 7 rules.
Almost certainly.
How dare you say that about almost Bosch? Certainly.
I will say that I think part of it is because
that's why Bosch lasted so long. It followed all 7 rules.
No, Bosch lasted that long because it was a creative enterprise that was invested in by the original writer and an army of talented
Titus Welliver just artists. soaking up the spotlight.
Honestly, based on intellectual property.
One of the rules, probably.
Yeah, certainly.
Not necessarily.
I think the problem, too, is, like, how does TV make money right now? And it's not as clear-cut. Like, yes, there's Game of Thrones, but then there's the 500 other shows on TV.
Libby, we're just in the clicker. That sounds like an entire episode.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How does TV make money?
Well, yeah, like, fair. But, yeah, it's a confusing time, and I think Donald Glover was absolutely accurate, and I think the real story is how everyone read the quote wrong.
Well, speaking of really canceled, Dakota Johnson's favorite birthday party pal, Ellen DeGeneres, has mentioned that she will be leaving her show in 2022. What's her reasoning? Let's see here. As great as the show is and as fun as it is, it's just not a challenge anymore. And when you're a creative person, you constantly need to be challenged. So that's what Ellen DeGeneres told The Hollywood Reporter.
She was challenged for the 15 seasons before this?
Yeah.
That's really upsetting. So I guess
it has nothing to do with any of the flack that Ellen or her producers got for discrimination within the crew. I think
abuse, and
it's just the challenging aspect of it.
Yeah, the challenge is to not have more stories like that come out. The challenge is to stop treating her staff that way.
The challenge was to have a couple of news cycles in a row where there wasn't negative news.
She failed. Yeah, it's okay. Good riddance. I watched
Good
it
riddance.
In a auto glass repair shop once. I feel like that's the extent of.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to. Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We're into the meat, guys. Into the meat.
Oh, now. Now we're into the meat.
Now we're into the meat. Today, Thursday, May 13th, the first three episodes of Hacks drop on HBO Max. Am I right about that, Libby? And then last Friday, May 7th, the first two episodes of Mythic Quest second season dropped. And then next Monday, the final episode of Breeders second season will air. So I guess let's talk about comedy. Libby, you have been talking about Hacks. You've been talking about Hacks off the record for quite some time now.
I have.
About how you think it is the best comedy coming, and that if anything can unseat the great Ted Lasso at this year's Emmys, why not Hacks?
Yeah, I do feel that way. Hacks, I've seen five episodes of. The first one is probably the weakest, which is why it's nice that they're releasing three.
I think they might only be releasing two.
Well, you check on that. I'll give people, if you aren't familiar, Hacks is an upcoming HBO Max comedy from the producers of Broad City. It stars Gene Smart as a faded Las Vegas stand-up comedian who has this huge stage show and is just a legend, who is forced to hire a, like, 25-year-old comedian who had disproportionate success. She was discovered when she was 20 and was supposed to have this big, illustrious career until a wayward internet comment kind of derailed all of that.
Cancel culture.
Cancel culture. It's the theme. That's the word of the day.
The theme of the pod.
Yeah. The young comedian played by Hannah Einbinder, who comes from comedy royalty. Her mom's Lorraine Newman, who's an original cast member on SNL. It's amazing. Partially because it made me laugh out loud several times, which just doesn't happen as much anymore. But it's also a very interesting examination of what women need to do to succeed. What they sacrifice and honestly how they feel about each other in that scenario. It looks at the generation gap. I like describing it all sounds kind of trite and terrible, but it's incredibly funny and it's incredibly moving. And so much of that credit goes to Jean Smart, who's a consummate actress who has found huge success playing comedic and dramatic roles. So many times when you see shows about comedy, like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, they aren't funny, which is a problem because comedy is supposed to be funny. But that is not at all a problem in this show. They'll workshop jokes and they'll actually get better, which just doesn't happen on other shows. I don't know. It's really good. It's not going to beat Ted Lasso, because I then went back and rewatched Ted Lasso. Ted Lasso is just the balm that everyone needed to get through the last 18 months or so. But I feel very strongly that Hacks will be nominated in series. Partially, it's a very weak category, but also it absolutely deserves it. And if there were a show that could stand up to Ted Lasso, I do think this is it. I'm very anxious to see the rest of the season. I have heard rumors that the rest of the screeners might go out tomorrow. So we'll see. But for now, I just really love it. I would suggest checking out the first two episodes. If it's not for you, I get it. But I just love it. I love ladies and ladies being funny.
Well, what I'd say about hacks is, one, Libby is 100% right, as always. We would never disagree on anything. But the impressive thing to me is that it does set itself up to fail at almost every single turn. Like, as you mentioned, this is a showbiz comedy, which there's been plenty of very famous, successful ones, like 30 Rock is immaculate, The Larry Sanders Show is fantastic. Like, you can expand that dating much further back as well. But, like, the stuff that's really trying to take place in a writer's room and talk about what's happening in writing and in comedy and all that, I feel like they're very hard to pull off. The ones that are actually trying to be funny, I feel like that's even harder. Like, I mean, Studio 60 is a pretty famous bomb. There's also I'm Dying Up Here, which is the Showtime series from a few years ago, executive produced by Jim Carrey. But both of those were technically like hour-long dramas. So, like, they could kind of cheat their way around it, where it's like, listen, we don't have to be funny. The problem with Studio 60 was that the jokes they said were funny also weren't funny. So that is another thing where it becomes a problem. Like, it's like, right, you not only have to give the audience a joke, like, watch it be constructed and hope that they laugh at it while it's being constructed, you like, which is a very hard thing to do. You also have to be convincing and correct that the jokes are funnier, that you're making them better, that whatever you're saying is the good joke is actually good and distinguishably better than the bad joke, which is not an easy thing to do.
Well, I think what's interesting about the two things you just brought up, Ben, is the fact that both 30 Rock and the Larry Sanders Show, to a certain extent, are mocking the thing that they are doing. So Larry Sanders, like, he is mocking what these talk shows are within the structure of a talk show. And 30 Rock, sort of insanely, essentially treats SNL as if it's the worst show on the planet. If you think of it as, like, this is Tina Fey writing about her experience, like, beep, beep, ribbit, ribbit, werewolf bar mitzvah. Like, these are shitty, shitty sketches. And, like, what's funny about it is how bad the sketches are. And it's her sort of expounding upon the fact that, like, this show is ridiculous. Everything we do is ridiculous. You don't have to worry about the jokes within the show being good, because that's not what the meat of the show is.
They're absolutely right. Satiric. Though, yes, I would say that the Larry Sanders Show did the hard thing where the show that it created, the parts of the late night show that we saw, whether it was his monologue at the beginning or the interviews that he did with people, a lot of them are very funny. Like, they managed to make the thing that's supposed to be funny, funny and convincing in its send up of these other late night programming, as well as, you know, what happens behind the scenes at the late night programming. And Hacks very much, you know, gets into the behind the scenes stuff, but it is not a satire. Like, it is trying to show rather sincerely how hard it is to make these careers work. And I think if there's a flaw in the show, it is in that kind of generational divide, in that Ava, the younger comedic writer, is, like, so often thrown under the bus to elevate Gene Smart's character, like, to show how hard Gene Smart worked to be there and to show, you know, the ignorance of this young millennial who didn't even bother to study this quote-unquote legendary performer. They so often make cracks about that it can be hard to root for the writer. Like, whenever a character on TV, and this is a bugaboo for me in particular, whenever a character on TV is presented as someone who's rather lazy or doesn't want to work that hard, I usually check out pretty quick. And I think that they're actively making choices to show that she's progressing from that state to another state. But it's harder to see the benefit for Gene Smart, you know, like, it's easy to see it from a kind of familial daughter replacement kind of relationship, but it's less clear how beneficial it is for her career. Other than, you know, I guess she might, if she ever agrees to take some of these jokes, get into it with a younger audience. But yeah, I think it's very easy to respect Hacks for accomplishing as much as it does, which with the amount of obstacles it put in its own way. And it's absolutely a distinct version of this show. It's absolutely funny. It absolutely has, like, just incredible story structure. Like, the writing on this is just so well done, that you it's almost like I can see the show it's becoming at, like, before it becomes it. Like, you can just invest in it because they've earned that trust with the way that they set it up episode by episode by episode and progress these characters towards something where you're like, I already want season two. I already want it to be here so I can just enjoy that. And I don't have to worry, like, is it going to develop into this? Like, are they going to push past this part? But yeah, it's great.
I think that was the impetus for my immediate joy over the show and my very bold statements re Ted Lasso was that I can see what this show could be, like, very soon, like maybe in the next few episodes, and I'm so into it and I want it. I don't know how it's a second season, how it has a second season, honestly, but I am very passionate about what I suspect the show is about to become.
I'm very excited to watch for several reasons. One, Jean Smart is a national treasure, and I'm glad that the rest of the world has finally caught up. Two, Libby's been talking so highly about it, and I just want to make sure that Stress Libby and I don't have to have a fight about Hacks.
I don't want
to
have a fight.
That'd be great.
But three, and this isn't really a reason, but just to sort of cement the fact that I compare all of the big entries in this year's Emmy comedy race to movies from the 1980s. It just feels like the movie Punchline, except instead of gender being the sort of dividing line between the two leads, it's age.
And I haven't seen that movie, but
and
that
I'm fine. Great. I'm fine with that. I mean, I haven't seen Punchline in a long time. I don't know if
everybody remembers Punchline. That's not. I mean,
do you guys remember Punchline? Tom Hanks? No?
Yeah, he's a person I know.
Oh, it's good. Sally Field plays a house mom who has free time on her hands or something and, like, goes to a comedy club and joins an open mic. And Tom Hanks is, like, a comedian trying to, like, desperately make it. And he's, like, very good. He's, like, great. Like, the comedians love him. And he takes her under her wing and, like, starts to teach her comedy. And she blows up and becomes more successful than he does. And, like, there's a big shot at, like, getting on, like, a Carson type show, and like he blows it, like eats it, and she does super well and she gets it, and the whole movie is sort of like based on that trajectory. Sorry if I ruined the movie Punchline for everyone.
Yeah, spoilers for that 20.
You've had 32 years, 33 years to watch it.
Oh my God. I'll get around to it eventually. Unlike Ava, I will respect the comedy of our past.
And Ted Lasso,
unlike Leo, honestly.
Ted Lasso blew past what I thought was just going to be Major League Redux. It was not that. It was much better, though I still have a soft spot for the USA Network version of Major League with no curse words.
I would have been so upset with this podcast if you hadn't mentioned the USA version of Major League with no curse words.
At the end, when Dorn goes up to Wild Thing Vaughn and hands him the ball, instead of saying, strike this motherfucker out, he says, strike this guy out. Ben, speaking of workplace comedies.
Nailed it.
Segway! Mythic Quest returned after having two sort of like mini episodes during the pandemic, one filmed entirely remotely, like everyone was in their own space with the exception of the two leads for quarantine, and then sort of a return episode that happened a couple of months ago in anticipation of the season. But you reviewed it, you said it's back and it's great. I forget what your first line of your like in process review was. It was like, It's here. And I said,
I don't know, it's really good.
And I said, publish it, you coward.
First and foremost, I have to correct you. The two leads were not together during the quarantine episode. They only made it look like they were for that one moment.
That's right.
And in fact, they weren't together. That was her roommate or husband or something. I don't really know. But
that's why Rob McElhenney is wearing the hoodie. So you can't tell. Yeah,
exactly. And that was
it's
very
like the
important.
Kissing on Pen 15.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Or the kissing at the end of Thor 2.
I immediately regret raising the point that I originally made and will instead go into the second broader point, which is
Mythic Quest is
yes,
back, baby!
Mythic Quest Season 2 is very good. It's also, to tie this back into Hacks, it is the actual realization of the second season that we want to see from Hacks. Like, Hacks, it's already like, let's get there. We got to have it. I want to have 20 episodes of this that I can just recirculate whenever I need. whenever I need them. And as I wrote in the review, Mythic Quest kind of snuck up and became that. I definitely felt like the first season was pretty well formed. It also has immaculate story structure and just great writers behind the scenes who know how to put together an ensemble workplace comedy and did a very, very good job with the first season. But it very quickly became clear to me that when the second season arrived, it was going to join the rotation of kind of feel good sitcoms for me that I'll just have on whenever I need it. It was just very easy to rewatch it. It was very easy to just keep sticking with it, and something that I felt like revisiting even when, you know, I didn't need the excuse of, well, I got to write the review. I should watch that again. I should brush up. It would just kind of keep popping up in my rotation. But this is a show that, on Apple TV Plus, so I don't know if as many people will see it as deserve to see it, but hey, if they subscribe for Ted Lasso, make sure you check this out as well. It's just very well done. Like, it's one of those things where after the first season, they identified kind of the strengths of their characters, of their dynamics, of the performers even. Like, Danny Pudi gets to do so much good shit in season two, and you're just so happy to see him do it within the same show. Like, I feel like he's an actor who, if you watch him in enough things, you see the range he's capable of, but rarely is he able to display that within one single thing. Obviously, Community gave him an opportunity to showcase a lot of that in very exciting ways, but since then it's been rather limited. And he gets to do that here, and it's very, very exciting. I still think that there's a little bit of a struggle with some of the standalone stuff that they try to incorporate into the season, because it's such a strong ensemble. Like, it's such a strong workplace comedy. You want to see them lean into that. And when they interrupt that for some sort of breakout, like they did in season one, where it kind of worked, at least it worked for more people than me, when they had the standalone episode with Kristen Milioti and Jake Johnson, that kind of showed how a creative partnership could be fractured by success. This year, they focus on something that's a little more specific to one character's backstory, and I don't know if it works as well as the rest of the season. But it is just a show that understands itself, that wants to talk about issues and elevate characters and performers and writers in ways that are very exciting to watch as somebody who loves television. And I just think it's a fun show. Like, I just think they get a lot of the details right. My sister, who works in coding, mentioned that a lot of the kind of tech setups that they have scattered around the office felt very accurate to, you know, real life people who are glued to their computers and work in this field. So they clearly are invested in some of the details. But it never feels like it's bogged down by that. It's very light on its feet, very fun, and I feel like the actors are really embracing the ensemble. So, I don't know if Mythic Quest is like the best comedy on TV, but having said goodbye to Superstore this year, I was very eager to have another workplace comedy step up and be like, no, we can do a lot of those similar things in our own way and fill that void for you just give us 5 years and we'll pump out 50 episodes. Like, that was the thing too about the quarantine episode, and then they had an Everlight episode. It felt like they understood that people needed the continuation of this. It felt like people, you know, they want to stay in this world. So rather than just wait, okay, we dropped 10 episodes this year, and a year we'll drop 10 more, it's like, maybe we can fill this gap a little bit. Maybe we can do the kind of broadcast TV thing without making 18 episodes where we stretch this as far as we can. And it worked for this guy, so I hope it works for everyone else as well.
I almost thought of it as like the BBC model of like, here's your holiday special, like here's your year-end special.
That's awesome. I would
love, that might be more fitting. Yeah,
love if the US got into that.
If shows did that. Yeah,
as someone who didn't subscribe to Apple Plus until this year,
until Ted Lasso?
You basically.
Oh no, that was last year.
Basically. Well, you know, this year.
Oh, it was for the Mosquito Coast. You wanted to watch
Right. I've seen that. Do I have to watch Mythic Quest? Would it behoove me to watch Mythic Quest season one? Is it something where season two is significantly better? Or what would you suggest for someone who is new to Mythic Quest?
No, I think you should start from the beginning. I feel like it's only additive. I feel like
for me, a lot of the value of strong ensemble comedies is living within them. It's letting them transport you to a different place and kind of just listen to the banter, enjoy existing in the background, and appreciate the dynamics that they create. There are certain things that you learn in season one that are important for season two.
Okay.
I also think that the growth of the two main characters played by Rob McElhenney and Charlotte Nickdow are, you know, it's very important to kind of understand how they started to appreciate what they're going through in the second season. But it is just an additive experience, really. Like, I think season two is better and better honed because they went through what they went through on season one. But that's the case with so many good comedies, with the people who, you know, listen to their audience as well as just learn from doing. Usually the second season is even stronger. So that's what they did.
I think what you were saying about comedies is totally right, that like you kind of have to watch the growing pains, if only because it sets up so many of... It's so much comedies. It's the setup, even if it's not exciting. Like, you do need to know why, you know, Ron Swanson is the way he is before you can let him be unvarnished Ron Swanson in season five. You know, like...
I mean, even the concept of a bottle episode, which everybody pretty much universally agrees is a lot of fun with a good ensemble cast, it's not the same when you first meet them. Like, if you started with a bottle episode, it's not going to be as good as if you incorporate it into your second season or, you know, eighth episode or something. And that's what Mythic Quest does. Like, they knowingly create a bottle episode in season two, and it's really good. Like, it's just, you appreciate it more because you know these people better, and the dynamics are better honed so that, like, the actual event within the bottle episode feels stronger and more resonant and funnier. So yeah, no, it's, I think it's just with a lot of first seasons of comedies, it's identifying the potential and whether or not they recognize that potential, you know, as they're creating it based on the trajectory that they've chosen originally. And to try to segue into, Leo's favorite television show of all time.
That's it. My favorite television show of all time.
This is a slightly different take, but it absolutely took me until the second season of Breeders to fully understand, or at least partially understand, what they were going for. It's not that I didn't like the first season. It's not that they did anything wrong. It just, for me to understand what the show was trying to accomplish, I guess, I had to see the time jump in season two and then realize, oh, okay, I think I get it now. But for you, Leo, you've known it all along. It's on your wavelength.
I'll try to be brief because we've gone long on a lot of shows and a lot of topics. But I think I said this up top. Breeders isn't for everyone, and I totally get that. I know that Steve was sort of lukewarm on it. Friend of the pod, Steve Green, the recommendation machine, was sort of lukewarm on the show, season one. And I think I understand that. It is very much in the current vogue of dramedies. It is not an out and out comedy. The whatever you want to call it. The last two episodes of season one, the last two episodes of season two, both get fairly dark and cover very dark topics and for parents of all stripes. And as someone who is not a parent myself, I could see someone being a parent, the show easily scaring them off immediately. Although maybe there is some ability to laugh at oneself. The main thing I think the show does super well, and to link it to another show that we have talked about previously in the podcast, Michael Patrick O'Brien, who's the showrunner for AP Bio, used to have a statement. AP Bio doesn't really do this a ton, but used to have this theory that, like, in comedy, there's a vase, essentially, which is the laugh. And as tension builds in any scene, you sort of start to stack the vase on higher and higher levels. And I think Breeders is stacking vases very high consistently. Now, you have to be on the same wavelength as the show to get that laugh. Otherwise, you'll just be like, this is incredibly crude, incredibly mean. It's not I don't understand what's funny about this. They're awful parents. Or this is too relatable and I hate that I see myself in these people. But I do think what Simon Blackwell and Chris Addison and Martin Freeman have created is like unique to me. I haven't seen a lot of shows that, you know, traipse in this garden of sort of despair and figuring it out as you go as a parent. It's my favorite show currently airing. Not of all time.
Emphasize the currently airing part.
Not of all time. But it is a hard watch, I'll say.
To put words in our good friend Steve's mouth, I think one of the things that hurt Breeders from the beginning in those early episodes was that the easiest comparison point for a lot of TV fans was the Amazon Prime UK import Catastrophe, in that both of them were trying to take a more honest yet honest look at being a parent of young children. And Catastrophe, you know, was such its own thing. Like, it just kind of owned that space in a way where it didn't feel like there was a lot of room for other people to you know, jump in. And that was my immediate comparison point as well. So a lot of Breeders felt like kind of the lighter version of it. It wasn't even that it was too dark or that it was trying to out-dark Catastrophe. It was just like it was focusing on, you know, Martin Freeman's characters, kind of rage issues. And that was a very, like, heavy talking point within the original season. And I was just like, I don't know where you're going with this. I don't really know how I'm supposed to feel watching it. I don't really know what you're trying to say about it. And then when season two hit and they took a time jump forward, you know, I don't know exactly how long it was. It was like 7 years or something. It was a significant time jump. And you see kind of how these kids have developed with a dad who, you know, felt that way, had those thoughts, took it out on his kids sometimes, but then sought out help and tried to, you know, do what he could to correct it. It suddenly clicked for me. Like, it just felt like, okay, this is actually trying to show the consequences rather than worry about just how the parents survive this. Like, rather than like, okay, how do you survive having your first kid? How do you get through the first couple of years? How do you, you know, get past the point of just worrying about keeping them alive and then move on to being, you know, a quote unquote happy family? It's actually looking like, oh, no. How do your decisions and how does your behavior around the kid, like around when you're making these choices, when you're in that situation, have an impact on them for the rest of their lives? And that's such a big question. That's such a big issue to leap on that I kind of loved the challenge of it and appreciated a lot more of season two because you could see the results in believable and very funny ways. So I hope it gets another season.
Yeah, I think I just mean dark in terms of like the. I mean, this is not spoiling too much, but the general premise of the pilot of the series is that Martin Freeman is trying to get his kids to sleep and takes them out in the car in the middle of the night, and his wife Daisy Haggard thinks he may have murdered the children. Like, that is
that is the
pilot.
It is dark. Like, I'm not saying it's not dark. I just,
like, she calls the cops. She thinks he may have literally murdered the children.
Right. It sets a pretty high bar. I just considering some of the things that are said in Catastrophe, it didn't feel like that was enough to distinguish it from that old show or to be like, yeah, they can do this too. And again, eventually it clicked. It's like, they're not really trying to do that. That's not really what the mission statement of this show is. So, you know, if you can tolerate it, like you said, Leo, if it's more than just a horror show for you, then I think there's a lot to appreciate.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Guys, we got to get to the murder rankings.
Oh, no.
We got to get to Leo's murder power rankings.
Speaking of comedy.
We just had the fourth episode of Mayor of Easttown. I want to get the synopsis up. With Mayor forced to take a backseat on the case, Colin presses a local priest about the vague circumstances that prompted his transfer to the parish. Meanwhile, an anonymous call gives Dawn hope that Katie might still be alive. A lot happened this episode. Mostly, Mayor still working the case because she can't. You can't have her not work the case. So she shows up to Colin's. Shows up to Colin's house with his mom. He introduces her as my mayor. Maybe the moment of the series. This is my mayor. I mean, my partner mayor.
So cute.
So without further ado, here are my top five potential murder rankings. Number five, I'm doing a cheat. I'm gonna do a tie, and some of this is based off the scenes from next week. But I'm gonna give Brianna and Jess. So Brianna is Dylan's girlfriend, who beat the shit out of Aaron, and then Jess is Aaron's best friend. I'm giving them equal odds. Jess told Mayor where the journals were, and then the journals weren't there. Why did Jess take the journals? She's involved in some way, shape, or form, and I think we're gonna find that out. Number four, she wasn't in this episode, but I'm sticking with my thoughts on Faye. I think they might be hiding. Faye is again. Faye is Frank's wife to be.
I love this.
Every time I say Faye, the fact that you guys both glaze over probably means I'm very, very wrong on Faye. But here's my
listen. Here's the thing. There are so many fucking characters on this show. Like,
yeah.
I'm not so many entirely East Townians. Sure I know the name of the killer. My thinking on Faye, I think we don't know the name of the killer. Well, yeah. No, I don't. I have my suspicions.
We just know more than Leo does.
I should also state this, and I think I mentioned this to Ben off pod, but there's a lot of bad shit happening in Easttown. My murder power rankings are only for the murder of Aaron, not for whoever is kidnapping women. I think these are different crimes perpetrated by different people. So I don't want that to get confused, because obviously it's seemingly a man who is kidnapping these women and putting them in the pub, in the back of the pub. So
yeah, this week we did see the pub for the first time, so that was fun.
So when I suggest Faye, I'm not saying that Faye is kidnapping these women. I'm saying Faye killed Aaron potentially because of the relationship that Frank was carrying on with her. Frank, we know, was drunk and passed out after singing Uptown Girl, so we know it wasn't him. We have photo evidence that Frank was asleep.
I never saw a timestamp on that photo. Did she look at it as carefully as she looked at the video surveillance for the peeper in the season or in the first episode? She just deleted that shit. She was like, fuck you, gone.
Where is the peeper? Not in my top five. We'll have to see when the peeper pops back on the top five. He's not on my top five. I know I've been researching. Everyone's got their murder list. A lot of people say the peeper's still out there. It's not the peeper. I don't think the peeper did the killing. Number three, I'm sticking with my gut. Richard Ryan, Guy Pearce, too big a name. He's got to be on the list. I don't care if it seems like he has good intentions with Mayor. He's new to town. He hit up the app where they're looking for escorts, and he somehow ended up killing Aaron. That's just what I'm thinking. Two, this is definitely based on scenes from next week, but the cousin of the dad of the girl who was killed. That's right, Billy Ross. You're back on my radar, buddy. What are you up to? What are you hiding in that toolbox?
As you're going through your list, I'm trying to remember
what I've seen.
What you've seen and like what you might have seen in the next week on. So it's just like, yeah, I have an idea of what.
Billy Ross hasn't been on the episode, but hasn't been on an episode since episode two, I don't think. But so we haven't seen him in two episodes, but I think he's going to jump back into the rankings. He's at number two. And number one, I think I might be alone in this. Colin Zabel. I know he's a sweetheart. I know he says my mayor.
He's my mayor. She's my mayor.
I just think he's this loser. He probably does need to use potentially escort sites to get dates. I think he solves. I think he solves crimes by knowing everything on the inside. Look, am I wrong? You bet. Are these five insane? Of course they are. But Colin Zabel, number one with a bullet. He's the murderer.
Am I wrong? You bet.
Mayor Millions of Screens is a production of the Penske Media Corporation Anywhere. Our theme music featured excerpts of the classic YouTube video, Bjork Talking About TV and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Our editor-in-chief is Anna Harris-Brightson, and our publisher is James Israel, and our executive editor is Ann Donahue. Brought to you by some of our favorite second seasons of television. Ben is, of course, going to stub for The Leftovers. Libby suggested The New Girl. I'm going with Arrested Development, which I think actually improved upon a pretty perfect first season. And as a group, Millions of Screens endorses skipping the second season of Friday Night Lights.
No, absolutely not.
Skip it.
You do not skip any seasons of the greatest television show ever made.
Is that also when Saracen is sleeping with his grandmother's caretaker? Is that the same season?
Also,
Landry killing that guy.
I would like to start a running list of shows that Ben calls the greatest show of all time. Because
there's two of them on that list.
Yeah, I know.
I just gave four shows and two of them are the greatest show of all time. Yeah. You can find us on Twitter at a million screens, at Midwest Spitfire, at Ben T. Travers, and at Leo Adrian Garcia. Remember, if you have other Mayor Murder Power Rankings, make sure to tweet it at all of us. Tell us who you think the killer is. As always, this is Ben, Libby, and Leo reminding you that you shouldn't let poets lie to you.
You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
Ain't nothing wrong with a couple of cold brews and a cool podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.